Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. First Thursday of the month, and we continue our series of Friends of the Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. Today, the future of education, skills, and work, staying relevant in a world changing faster than ever. Our guest is Ben Pring, IT futurist, co-founder of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work, co-author of the forthcoming book, Monster, A Tough Love Letter to Machines That Rule Our Jobs, Lives, and Future. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, Mindy. Good morning.
So let's start with your work at Cognizant. Tell us a little bit about that and your organization.
Yeah, well, Cognizant's a big technology consulting and services company. We help large banks, airlines, insurance companies, government departments run the technology that they kind of rely on now. We've got about 300,000 people, would you believe, all around the world doing this kind of work for lots of companies. And the group I run is best way to think about it is a think tank within the organization, creating research, thought leadership, as we call it, points of view, really, about how technology is impacting business and more broadly the world that we live in.
So you're tracking trends across technology, business, and society, and you've been looking at trends for a long time, and I'm wondering how this unforeseen pandemic has impacted what might have been predicted. In some ways, I guess it has escalated what we thought would happen farther into the future in regards to what the office may look like.
No, that's exactly right, Mindy. Yeah. No, I've lived in the world of sort of predictions and disruptions and you know, talking about the future for all of my professional career, but you know, frankly, COVID has been humbling to people like me because this is real disruption. You know, people like me talk about you know, technology disruption all the time, but this is real disruption. This is, I think, the biggest existential challenge all of us have faced probably since the Second World War, and we're still in the midst of it. We're still dealing with it, and clearly, the virus doesn't respect the Julian calendar. It doesn't know the difference between January and December, and is you know, clearly, unfortunately, continuing to kind of change and mutate amongst us. And so much is uncertain as a result of it. And clearly, in the world of work that everybody has been dealing with, the world of you know, changing work in the last year, it's been extraordinarily disruptive. And a lot of people who haven't worked remotely, who haven't worked online historically, you know, previously, are clearly still getting used to that. But to your point, I mean, I think really the ultimate takeaway from what's going on at the moment is that COVID is an accelerant of a lot of trends that have been bubbling up, but perhaps been on the edge of many people's radar for a while, and really brought these themes bang into the middle of that radar. And as you say, the office is going to change fundamentally. The commute's going to change fundamentally. How we work, where we work, when we work, all of these things are going to change. And there's going to be a lot more change, I think, in the next few years than perhaps there's been in the last few years.
Yeah, and there's some people, you know, change is tough for a lot of people. Not everybody likes change. And we're talking about challenges, but there's also opportunities here, and we're going to get to some of that. But in this time of uncertainty, many are wondering, when will we get back to normal? And what we used to think of as normal may never be again. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Mindy. I mean, anybody who tells you, anybody who suggests they know exactly when we're going to go back to the office, go back to that kind of old model of working, I think nobody really knows, do we? We're all at the mercy of the virus at the moment. But you're absolutely right. I think the notion that once we're vaccinated, once we're safe to move around the world again, that we sort of just go back to that old model, if you like, a kind of 9-to-5, Monday to Friday, sitting in an office, sitting in a you know at a desk all day. I think that probably doesn't go back to normal. I think what certainly I see on my travels, talking to a lot of people around the world, and certainly here in the US as well, is that actually, you know, the silver lining in this cloud is that a lot of people are actually seeing the upside of not having to commute, not having to be in the office all of the time. And whilst that's sort of come around through unfortunate circumstances, I think a lot of people actually are seeing that the way that people like me have worked for a long period of time, you know, remotely, working online, you know, there's a lot of upside in that. So I think that the recalibration of what a kind of working day is, what a working week looks like, what an office looks like, that is going to be quite fundamentally different in the next few years.
Yeah. There have been some who thought working from home would be less productive. But tell us what we're actually seeing. That is not really what's happening for most, right?
No, that's, I think, the surprise to many people. Not a surprise to me, because I've always thought this is more productive. That's why I live in Falmouth. I travel for my job, but when I'm not with a client or at an event somewhere in the world, I work here, and I find this and have found this for 25 plus years much more effective than getting up in the morning, commuting into an office, sitting at a desk all day. That's, I think, the pleasant surprise. And people in this part of the world who sort of schlepped up to Boston on a Peter Pan bus every day for a long period of time. And that's pretty inefficient, frankly, and pretty draining and wearing on people. And certainly I've talked to, you know, very senior people in large organizations who previously would spend a lot of time flying around the world to meet with clients, with their teams. They're now realizing, well, I can speak to my people in Sydney, Australia, I can speak to my people in LA, I can speak to my people in London, I can speak to my people in South Africa, all in the same morning. I can bounce from call to call, from Zoom call to call, speak to everybody from my house. And that's more efficient for me, more productive for me. The wear and tear on me is less. And initially, people were kind of a little nervous to admit that. But now CEOs, you know, big people in business are admitting that much more freely. And I think that's why the notion that we go back to just to the old world unchanged, that's probably not accurate. And why the notion of this recalibration of what work looks like when we can come out of our homes again is going to be much more significant, much more material than perhaps initially people thought.
So what do you think the office of 2025 will look like? Who do you see in the room together?
Yeah, I think that the way I think about it, Mindy, is that what we're realizing because of COVID is that what I call heads-down work, where you're looking at the computer, you're writing something, you're filling out a form, you're doing your email, whatever it is you're doing, when your head is down, that can be done anywhere. That can be done in your bedroom, in your office, in, you know, Starbucks, when we can go back to a Starbucks, wherever. But the heads-up work, where you need to look at your colleague, look at your client, you need to collaborate, you need to be creative, you need that sort of energy of collaboration, that's better done face-to-face. I think that's what we're all finding at the moment, is we can do all of that heads-down stuff in this kind of new at-home online model. But we're all feeling the absence of being together to do that more collaborative heads-up work. So if you buy that logic, play that out into, as you say, what the office of 2025 looks like, I think the office becomes that collaborative space, that creation space, almost the R&D space for a business, where you go in to be with other people, deliberately to be with other people and not to be doing heads-down work online. I can imagine in a scenario in which that office becomes a Wi-Fi-free environment, not free Wi-Fi, but a Wi-Fi-free environment where we don't take our technology, we don't take our computers, we deliberately leave those outside of the room so we can do that human work together. Obviously, initially, we'll have to do that with social distancing protocols, and we'll have to redesign the office. But I think eventually, the office becomes a much more social space, much more domesticated space in a way, rather than this sort of, you know, pretty unattractive, frankly, office environment that many people still work in, many people will be familiar with, all sort of cubicles jammed together, and everybody really not particularly happy in that kind of environment. So I think initially there's going to be sort of minor reconfiguration of the office for this social distance era, which we'll still have to have in place, even with the vaccine and, even with us able to go back to the office in the first place. But over the longer term, certainly the medium term into that sort of 2025 period, I think you'll see the office look very, very different, probably to what it looks like today.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're with this, where you can imagine people, obviously, you're saying working, we're not working that 9 to 5, right? It'll be different hours. And this Peter Pan bus to Boston, and one of the reason people do that is the traffic is just horrendous and getting worse all the time. So this really would have quite an impact on rush hour across the nation.
I think it could. I think it could have a huge impact on that. And yeah, and anybody who's doing that on a regular basis into Boston or, you know, wherever around the world. I travel around the world and the traffic's terrible everywhere. Don't think it's just in this neck of the woods. No, I think people, more and more people are going to realize that doesn't make sense. I mean, there's an environmental, you know, aspect of this as well, perhaps we'll come on to. But no, I think it could become very much more normalized that people will go in, you know, odd hours, if you like. You can imagine a second shift. I want to work from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 10 o'clock at night. I want to work on a Sunday morning, whatever it is. I think, you know, again, if you think about the notion of consumer choice that we're all very comfortable with, you go to the supermarket and there are, you know, 50 brands of cereal, that sort of consumer choice is very normal. But we all have been forced to work in a very kind of standardized one-size-fits-all model in the last, you know, 150 years since modern bourgeois work was invented. I think what we're going to see is much more choice, much more flexibility, much more variability in the way that people work. And this is certainly going to be true for an employer that wants to attract, you know, the best and the brightest people. That those types of people are not going to be comfortable to be shoehorned into that old model. So, yes, that could have huge implications on the you know, the commute, that regular commute. I certainly think that regular commute is probably going to be one of the casualties of the virus, and probably that's a good thing.
Tell us about your commute.
my commute is like I leave my house. Whenever I'm going to start work, I drive to the local Dunkin' Donuts, and then I come back to my house and I start working.
We're talking with Ben Pring, our topic today, the future of education, skills, and work, staying relevant in a world changing faster than ever. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and the Friends of the MBL Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. Our guest is Ben Pring, IT futurist, co-founder of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work, co-author of the forthcoming book, Monster, A Tough Love Letter to Machines That Rule Our Jobs, Lives, and Future. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation this morning. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we're talking a little bit about how the office is apt to change, and travel is likely to continue to look very different than it does right now, right? We may not be attending all those conferences and business meetings.
Yes, no, I think that's very true. I mean, Warren Buffett certainly thinks that. He sort of sold out of his shareholdings of all the big airlines because he thinks this is, again, a very kind of hard, real reset. No, I think there's a CEO of a big company I spoke to recently who put it like this. He said he thought this was the end, the death of the single purpose visit. You know, what he means by that is a lot of business people, I'm sure people listening now would go, you know, fly to Chicago for one meeting or fly to you know, LA for a morning's event and then fly home. I'm guilty of that. I mean, I go to Australia to speak an event and come back. That's not unusual. Mm-hmm. And he thinks that that's kind of going to go away. And I think he's probably right in that. So I think we'll be more efficient, people who do travel for their work, so, you know, fly around the country, fly around the world. I think people will be more efficient. They'll try and bundle meetings together. They'll really think again, have that second thought of, does this really make sense to do this? Because we've become so used to just jumping on a plane as though it's a bus or a train. I think, again, this is giving us a kind of a reset, a moment to think and pause, and does that really make sense? And I think a lot of people are probably going to go, well, actually, it doesn't.
Now, we certainly saw travel, particularly air travel, change after 9/11. We saw the creation of the TSA, and you think we could see the creation of an HSA, health screening agency. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of the, again, the sort of longer-term consequences of this, this moment, that we can't live hostage to the next pandemic. We can't live hostage to the next virus once we get beyond COVID. So, yeah, if you think about that parallel between what happened after 9/11 and what could happen going forward, I mean, very quickly after 9/11, the TSA was created. I mean, if people can remember what flying was like before 9/11, you literally sort of rolled up to the gate 20 minutes before, takeoff. And it was all very casual and very, very sort of easy in a way. And, of course, that's what the terrorists exploited. But because of 9/11, a whole infrastructure of screening and security was created to ensure that something like that never happened again. And thank God it hasn't. And so I think the notion of a health security agency could be put in place, not just to fly, but literally to sort of go into any type of building. And perhaps one day, as the technology becomes more affordable and more broadly distributed, perhaps it's even in a domestic context, that you could have almost like an airlock on the side of the building, which you have to go through that, you have to be screened, and already stores are screening people when they go in with a temperature monitor. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of more sophisticated technology that will be created in the next few years. So I think that might be something that we begin to see, that sort of infrastructure emerges to allow us to move around the world, continue to move around the world, and as I say, not be held hostage to this happening again. Because I think if that does happen again, and it's probably very likely it will, the notion that we can lock down in the way that we're doing, time and time again, I think frankly that's going to be unrealistic.
No. Let's talk to Tim, who's giving us a call from Nantucket. Good morning, Tim.
Hey, good morning, Mindy. Nice to speak with you and Ben.
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
So I have a quick two-part. I have a quick two-part question. When technology developed, like laptops and then iPads and iPhones, it was generally thought that work centers and especially urban centers would kind of progressively decentralize as people could move out to suburbs and rural communities. So do you think that we got here accidentally and that it will stay? And then secondly, as far as measuring productivity, do you think the emphasis will now gravitate towards measuring which environments give more productivity?
Good questions.
Yes, no, great questions, Tim. To the first point first, the notion that we thought this decentralization would happen because of the technology 20, 30 years ago, that's absolutely true. And this has sort of been an unintended consequence in a way that the centralization, the gravitational pull of Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley in New York or Silicon Roundabout in New York, in London, as people talk about, that sort of acted as this gravitational force where all of the talent, all of the tech talent went to those places. And even though people, like me, worked remotely, I was the sort of exception to the norm. Younger people would go to Mountain View or San Francisco. They'd go to New York because that's where the technology was. That I think, wasn't what people imagined. But I think because of COVID and because the underlying technology has been developing and becoming more robust, more reliable and more broadly distributed, we are now going to be in that phase of decentralization that we sort of thought might happen 20 years ago. So again, if you're looking and sort of reading the tea leaves at the moment, lots and lots of people are realizing that this is an opportunity to break away from that gravitational pull of those centers. And of course, people now have the means of production literally in their hands. And you can do incredibly sophisticated things with the technology, which is literally in the palm of your hand now. And so if you look at, as one leading indicator of this, U-Haul, you know, the trucking company, people hire U-Hauls to move their furniture around the world, around America. The number one route for U-Haul, and this has been true for about 2 years now, but it's just accelerated, is from San Francisco to Sacramento. People are getting away from San Francisco because they can go and work in a cheaper place where they can arbitrage their salary, have a bigger house, bigger yard, but still be connected to work and still work in, you know, a very sophisticated way. So I think you're going to see more of that. And then to your second point about measurement of productivity, I think that's an excellent point. And I think this is where we're going to see a huge amount of innovation in management circles, management thinking circles in academia and in the sort of business world that I live in, to have much more, as you say, much more accurate measures of the productivity of how and where people do their best work. Because in a way, the sort of crude measure that has kept people tethered to their office, tethered to that cubicle from, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night for many people, is this notion of being present. The only measurement of your productivity is you're literally in the seat. You could be watching your ESPN on your phone in the office, but you're there, so you're productive. And that's clearly ridiculous and extremely crude. And so I think what you're going to see and beginning to see is much more sophisticated measures of, is somebody contributing? Is somebody, you know, person A working harder, contributing more than person B? So that's a great point, Tim, but I think a lot of people are going to focus on the reality of this new world we're in, and now let's optimize for that reality.
Tim, thanks so much for the question. If you have a thought or question you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the things we've seen during this pandemic, you know, we had telemedicine before, but telemedicine has really taken off. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on changes to the healthcare industry going forward.
Yes, no, that's an excellent point. In fact, I made a prediction this week that I think by year end, 50% of primary health consults will be telemedicine consults. I think you're absolutely right, Mindy. This has just exploded. And again, this technology has been around for a while, but because of COVID, it's becoming very routine and very normalized. And again, I've spoken to doctors locally and nationally who are recognizing this, realizing the benefits of this for them in the same way that CEO I talked about earlier on is recognizing the benefit of being able to Zoom around the world rather than fly around the world. So I know there's huge benefits to doing this. It's much more efficient for both the health provider and for you as an individual. I think that initial triage, that initial conversation is going to be routinely done through a telemedicine platform. And again, there's a you know, behind the scenes on the, in the technology industry, there's a lot of work which has been going on for a while, but it's just accelerated again to innovate in that whole area, make that whole process, that experience for a consumer, you know, more efficient, more attractive, just a better all around experience. I always think, I mean, it's a funny thought in some ways, but you know, if somebody came back to the world now, came back to America or the UK now from 100 years ago and went to see a doctor today, that it would be completely the same experience that they remembered from, you know, when they were really around in the world. That experience of how we receive healthcare hasn't really changed very much. And I think this is going to be one of the key areas, one of the most profound changes we see going forward, and one of the most important changes, because we all know how inefficient many aspects of healthcare are and how important it is. There's a huge necessity here to kind of be very innovative and inventive.
Yeah. We have an email question. So we have all this new technology to meet remotely, but haven't we realized during the pandemic how important personal contact can be? It doesn't seem to be a balanced trade-off.
Well, I think that's right. I think that comes back to this notion I mentioned earlier on of heads up versus heads down work. I think we're all absolutely feeling that lack of human contact and that desperate need to have that human contact. And so I think, again, that's absolutely right, that we do want to go back to our spaces. We want to go back to be with people, but we're realizing we don't need to go back to those spaces just to do our email. In fact, we want more of the human contact when we're together rather than people all sitting around a table at dinner or in an office all looking at their phones.
Another email question. Do you see higher education changing in the future? And if so, how?
Yes, again, I mean, I talked about healthcare as this very, very important pillar of society in desperate need for change and reform and innovation. I think the same is absolutely true of education. And a lot of people have been calling for that and pointing out the inefficiencies, the issues in all aspects of education for a long period of time. And again, I think this is a jolt, a kind of wake-up call, because we've forced our kids, young kids, older kids in college, to be online. And frankly, we're all realizing it's a pretty inferior experience they're all having. My own kids are struggling with it, not enjoying it, kind of miserable. And I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. So again, in that notion of, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, there is this huge need and thus a huge opportunity to completely change the way that we think about educating our kids. And it's not just the online or the offline, the, you know, in-person versus at-home discussion. It's there's a lot of technology, very sophisticated technology that's emerging that's going to be useful for teachers in helping their kids, teaching their kids, and helpful for their kids as well. There are examples bubbling up in a lot of different places where education institutions are using artificial intelligence software to help in configure a learning program for an individual kid rather than just this traditional 1 to 30 or 1 to 20 model or 1 to 400 model in universities, colleges, where there's a teacher, a lecturer standing up in front of 400 people. And this is very kind of crude, simplistic, one-to-many model. With the use of this very sophisticated technology, you can create individual learning journeys for all of those kids, recognizing that all of those journeys are going to be quite different, and the kids are going to be at different places on that journey. And I think that's going to be something we're going to see more of. Of course, it sounds scary to many people, and to your point earlier on, Mindy, a lot of people don't like change, they're uncomfortable with change, intimidated by technology. But the reality is that I think that's an unstoppable technology force, really meeting an object that does need to move, if you follow me. Yeah. It's something that does need reform, because we kind of recognize the limits and the downsides of old traditional approaches, I think.
There's something you talk about that I think is really interesting and I think would be appealing to what we call lifelong learners now. We have this, you know, model, you go to school, you go to college, then you get this job and, you know, you spend your career in this one particular job. And you have this thought going forward that maybe we aren't doing, you know, 4 years or 8 years of college all at one time, that it kind of comes in dribs and drabs. So tell us a little bit about that idea.
Yeah, it's the concept, we call it sort of university for life. You know, rather than going to BU or UMass Amherst at 18 or 19 for 4 years, why not go for 1 year, then go and work for 10 years, then go back for your second year when you're 30, then go and work another 10 years, then go back when you're 40, and then go back for your fourth year when you're maybe 50 or 55. Recognizing the fact that the world is changing so quickly, that the skill requirements in the real world that you can as an individual monetize are very volatile, rather than go and do one thing and then try and monetize that one thing for 40 or 50 years or even longer, 60 years, people are going to be living longer, needing to work longer. Why not make that a sort of lifelong relationship? This could be a kind of alum model on steroids, where a university has that lifelong relationship with a student, with a person, and helps them through the entire journey of their working life. It sounds a little crazy. It sounds a little sort of far out, but I've actually talked to a lot of educators in universities around America, and it always sort of intrigues them. And I think this is something that you're perhaps going to begin to see some experimentation around, because there is a very wide spread recognition, I think, that you know, traditional four-year model is increasingly not really that fit for purpose.
So what do you see as some of the jobs of the future? I know you get asked this question a lot. You know, people, you know, what are going to be the areas that you would look to for the jobs of the future?
Yeah. Now, we've produced a number of reports in this area, Mindy, really sort of created or catalyzed by the thought that a lot of people are nervous, as I said earlier on, about technology. They think automation and AI and these scary robots that you can see online are going to sort of take jobs away from human. And there's an element of truth to that, but it's also a little bit misleading, because the technology that we're developing, sure, it's going to take some aspects of work away from humans, but it's going to create lots of new work for humans to do. And the real trick for a young kid or even somebody in midstream of their career is to sort of look at the trends, the underlying trends of where is opportunity being created, and then, you know, skate towards that, try and orientate yourself into that area. So just to answer the question very specifically, I mean, a few thoughts. In this discussion around AI, artificial intelligence, this next generation of very, very clever software that's been emerging for a while and sort of driving Siri or Alexa or even your TV or your car nowadays, and you talk to those things. One of the concerns that many people are raising all around the world is that perhaps those algorithms, the software that drives that technology, is susceptible to bias. It's susceptible to giving you the same answer all the time, doubling down on the answer. The bias that's coded into that software by the engineers, you know, could potentially be a problem. And so one of the jobs of the future that we see emerging is what we call an algorithm bias auditor. Somebody that can go and look at that software, understand the biases, the decision frameworks that have been coded into the software, and make sure that that's really what the organization or the institution wants the end result to be. So that's one little idea, which again is we think is going to be quite significant. Another one, completely at the other end of the scale, which we think is going to be interesting and certainly relates to our discussion a little while ago about the commute, is, believe it or not, flying cars are actually emerging now. In Holland this week, the Dutch government has just licensed the first flying car in the world. And there's a huge amount of work going on, again, behind the scenes to develop that technology. One of the guys who founded Google, Sergey Brin, who has $50 billion odd in his back pocket, he spends no time working for Google nowadays. He works for a company he set up called Kitty Hawk, who are creating flying cars. And if you go to Kitty Hawk online and look at their job openings, there's hundreds and hundreds of jobs in that company to develop the technology, to develop the business around that technology. And that's going to create lots and lots of opportunity for people in the future, jobs of the future. So there's a lot going on, and people can find these reports on Cognizant.com. We did another one of these reports recently called 21 Human Resource Jobs of the Future, 21 HR Jobs of the Future.
And so there's lots of opportunities.
Harvard Business Review just featured that recently. So people can find all that and check it out online.
Yeah. We're talking with Ben Pring, the future of education, skills, and work, staying relevant in a world changing faster than ever. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly collaboration with the Marine Biological Laboratory and the Friends of the MBL Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. With us is Ben Pring, IT futurist, co-founder of Cognizant's Center for the Future of Work, co-author of the forthcoming book, Monster, A Tough Love Letter to Machines That Rule Our Jobs, Lives, and Future. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking a little bit about artificial intelligence before the break, and I have finished, you know, there's sort of this, some people have this, I don't know, conspiracy theories, right? That, you know, Alexa's listening in on every word and works for the CIA. If you ask her so, I thought, this will be funny. So I said, Alexa, do you work for the CIA? And the answer was, I work for Amazon, which I thought was kind of funny. But there is a sort of sci-fi version that comes to people's mind, which is not exactly reality.
Yes, I mean, obviously we've seen AI in the movies and in fiction our entire life. I mean, the first kind of scary technology book, Frankenstein, just celebrated its 200th birthday. So we've sort of grown up with that, and we have this expectation that, you know, AI is this sort of malevolent force out to get us. I mean, that's interesting. I think, you know, there's some element of truth in that, but I think the reality is a little bit more mundane. And I like to point to a company called X.AI, which is a, you know, relatively small company in New York that uses this very sophisticated technology to schedule meetings, to help you schedule a meeting, rather than, you know, you and I sending emails back and forth. I can, you know, talk to you on Wednesday, or you can talk to me on Tuesday. You just say to your little piece of software, set up a meeting with Ben, and it just does that automatically. And I think that's much more the reality of what AI is. It's just very clever software that's going to help us do mundane, boring tasks like that, and in the process change what we do. But it isn't this sort of scary Terminator movie that we've seen, you know, seen on the big screen.
Yeah. Now, but technology has been advancing at such a rapid pace. And in your forthcoming book, A Monster, A Tough Letter to Machines That Rule Our Jobs, Lives, and Future, the question is posed, have we created a technology monster? And we're talking here about the cell phone, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is an incredible thing that's still very new and has barged its way into the middle of all our lives. And, of course, with tremendous upside, tremendous advantage and wonderful things that it's wrought. But at the same time, we can all see the downside, the dark side of what that phone and social media is doing to us. And so this is really what we try to grapple with in this book, Monster, coming out in March, that we've got to sort of make the balance between, you know, leveraging the upside of this, but at the same time trying to manage the dark side of it. And a simple metaphor to think about this is if you look at a picture of, say, Falmouth High Street, Falmouth Main Street, excuse me, betraying my English roots there, Falmouth Main Street in, say, 1940, you'll see lots of cars, you'll see lots of automobiles on that road because the car has sort of been around for 30, 40 years by that stage. But you won't see any road markings, you won't see any yield signs, you won't see any stop lights. You won't see any of that infrastructure of the road that sort of keeps us safe. And I think really what we've done with the internet, Al Gore's information superhighway, people might remember that that phrase, is we've built this incredible road, this highway that we can all go down at 80, 90 miles an hour, but we haven't put in place any of that infrastructure on the road to keep us safe. And so that's what I think we're going to see going forward, because if you look at that, a picture of Falmouth Main Street in 1970, you see all of that infrastructure on the road. So I think the story of the next 20 years around technology is putting in place that infrastructure that allows us, again, to go very fast, to do all the things we want to do, but not, you know, injure ourselves, kill ourselves in the process.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too, that it's especially for some of us of an older generation, if you will, to look at how much has happened in, the last 40 or 50 years. I mean, I think we had a phone, but there was no such thing as an answering machine. And I mean, just the thoughts of, I remember telling my dad when I was a kid that I was going to live in a push button home. And I think that was from watching the Jetsons or something, but the things that are happening now, as in my childhood, if you said this, we would have thought that this is crazy. That's science fiction. It's amazing how
No, I agree.
far we've come so quickly.
I agree. I have the same thought. My father died in the early 90s, and I sometimes think that if he came back to the world now, he would think that I was living literally in a science fiction movie. He didn't see the internet. He didn't know what GPS was. He didn't know what virtual reality was. He didn't know what an app was. He didn't know what a social media was. No, I think you're absolutely right, Mindy. The pace of change in the last 25 years is absolutely extraordinary in the long arc of human history. I think, frankly, it explains why a lot of people are really struggling to sort of deal with the modern world because things are changing so quickly. It's sort of understandable, but an average normal human being isn't built to deal with this amount of change at this velocity of speed.
Yeah. And let's go look at the younger generation. What are your thoughts about some of the younger people who feel trapped in a matrix, so to speak?
Yeah, I think this is again, an underreported element of this whole story around social media and our phones, is that a lot of young people, I believe, are actually trying to find a way out of living in that world. They've sort of been born into this world, but they sort of would like to stop having to live every aspect of their life online. But the problem is, in a way, that an individual, may give up their phone or give up social media, but they're seen as an outcast. They're seen as an odd person for doing that because so much everything of their life is really, lived online. There are rock musicians, there are people in the social media world who are expressing this point of view. It's still sort of bubbling up. It's still not really very visible. But I do think this is, again, a change in the dynamic, a change in the conversation we're going to see going forward, that these things, which are still only, 10 years old, 15 years old, and have come to dominate everything, I think people are going to begin to question that more. And I don't imagine that people are going to turn their phones off or the government is going to turn this stuff off. But I do have a suspicion that more and more people, young as well as, older people, are going to begin to drift off and, put that phone down, do that digital Sabbath, that digital detox, more and more, recognizing we can't be online in the way we are at the moment all the time. It really is just isn't good for our health.
Yeah, so it's really about finding balance, right?
Balance, exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
no, that's
Yeah.
exactly right. Again, and I'm a tech evangelist. I love technology. I love the power of technology. I love what it's done. But I do, worry. I am concerned about that downside of it. And you're absolutely right. I think that's a great word. We need to find a better balance in the way that we're living with this technology.
And of course, data, that like that's what everybody's after now, right? Is all this data and how we protect our data and what happens to it is a big question now. And certainly, I guess that'll be a lot of legislative talk going forward, right? On what happens with data and our rights and to protect it, right?
Yes, no, again, I think this is one of the big battles ahead of us. And again, this is what we cover very much in this new book, is trying to think about that. People talk about data as the new oil. It's the new valuable resource in the world. And we've, again, we've allowed this to happen. This technology has sort of bubbled up, has developed, and we haven't really understood it well enough to be able to manage it. And data is particularly the real crux of this issue, because even to this day, many people don't really understand, when you talk about data, what it means and how big businesses are monetizing that, using that, leveraging it, how governments are using that. There's a professor up at Harvard Business School called Shuzana Zuboff, who wrote a very, very important book that people who are interested in this area should definitely read if they haven't come across it already, called Surveillance Capitalism. I think it's one of the most important books of our age, where she goes in extraordinary detail into how data is used by organizations. And frankly, it's not a pretty picture. And I think the legislation that we need is going to be complicated because of the fact that a lot of politicians don't really understand this themselves either. And so it's a very complicated issue. I think it's a very important issue, and people should certainly be paying more attention to this. You talked about Alexa listening to you earlier on. We sort of laugh at that. We sort of think that's funny. But I do think that's a very, very important issue we should be taking more seriously. I do think it's going to be something that we see in the media, the legislative programs we need to put in place, again, to keep us safe going forward. This is a very big deal, I think.
Yeah. So as we look at the sort of times we're in and you know, the pandemic and the changes, the bottom line is this is really a time for reinvention. There really is a lot of opportunity here.
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely the case. And again, as I said, I'm a sort of tech evangelist. But I love technology. I completely understand the power of it and the positive power, the opportunity created by it. And I think for anybody, again, a young person or a parent listening now, thinking about advising, you know, their kid where to go, where are the jobs of the future, anything related to do with technology, any flavor of technology, I mean, that's a smart thing to move towards. There's a lovely phrase that I like, created by the founder of Wired magazine. People may know Wired magazine, a guy called Kevin Kelly. And he says that the future of work rests on the phrase X plus AI. X being whatever it is you do. You're a teacher, you're a doctor, you're a radio host. If you add this next generation of technology to that X, what it is you do, then you're going to be able to get to the next level of whatever it is you do. And I think, you know, that's a nice, simple way to think about it. You shouldn't be fearing this technology and trying to run away from it. You should be steering towards it and trying to use it to help you in the work that you do.
Yeah. Just got about a minute and a half left, and I'm just wondering, thoughts on, you know, as you said, we can't put the genie back in the bottle. The technology is here to stay. We can't ignore it. We're trying to find some balance. So just maybe a thought for some struggling with that in the final minute or so that we have.
Yeah. I think this idea that people may be familiar with, the digital Sabbath, the digital detox, putting your phone down, being more deliberate, not having it in the bedroom, not having it to hand the whole time. I think there's good sense in that. I think there's good wisdom in that. I think the ability to go outside in the real world, you know, with a mask or not, that makes all the sense in the world. You know, technology is a tool that we can use, humans can use. And when it's a tool used well, it's a wonderful, powerful thing. When it's a tool that consumes you and overwhelms you and you become a slave to it, that's when it becomes a monster. That's when it becomes a problem. And I think that's the issue that we all individually and then collectively as a society have to deal with in the future.
Ben Pring, IT futurist, co-founder of Cognizant's Center for the Future of Work, co-author of the forthcoming book Monster, A Tough Love Letter to Machines That Rule Our Jobs, Lives, and Future, coming out in March. Ben, thanks so much for being with us. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much, Wendy. Great talking to you.
And we'll have more information about Ben and Cognizant at our website, capeandislands.org. First Thursday of the month, our Marine Biological Laboratory and Friends of the MBL Falmouth Forum lecture series. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.